Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
This is not about the Second Amendment. This is not about a weapon. This is not about a gun. This is about an accessory to a gun that allows a weapon to fire hundreds of rounds a minute. It allows this weapon to be more lethal.
The first step is to remove the gun-free zone and give our staff at the schools the ability to defend themselves and to deter those who may think that they can come to school and commit these crimes.
There's a bunch of uproar right now, and we've never seen something like this where people are consistently doing this and just coming together, and it's awesome, to be honest. Like, it's great. Like, something's being done.
There had been an exchange between Steve Montenegro, who was a state senator at the time, and this legislative staffer. One involved a topless photo that the staffer sent to Mr. Montenegro. She sent that to him, and his immediate response was Snap. He had advised her a few times to go to Snapchat.
And joining us to talk about guns on campus and the latest developments in the 8th Congressional District race are Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez. He's also Arizona's former superintendent of public instruction and attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Welcome to you both, guys. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Jaime, how strongly does Governor Ducey have to be on this issue of guns on campus, arming teachers, and whatnot? He's under some pressure from lawmakers to have a task force to prevent school violence, for example.
Right. Recently, there were 50 legislators that came out, 12 Republicans. And these weren't just what would be called the moderate Republicans. You have people like Jill Norgard, Maria Sims, Rusty Bowers. So you have some pretty strong conservatives that are talking about why there needs to be a comprehensive look at what happens. You know, a lot of the debate that's going on nationally, Arizona really can't control a lot of the gun, federal gun legislation. But, you know, the safety issues really need to be debated. What can we do as a state? And that's something that I think the governor would be well served if they took the lead on it rather than have forces pushing them to do something.
Roy, the issue of guns on campus has popped up a lot here in Arizona. What's your take on where the governor needs to stand on this? Because he is considered a very solid, if not conservative, Republican on this issue, and that could cause some political problems potentially.
Well, I agree with Jaime. I mean, I think that the reaction to the Parkland shooting has been different than the reaction to some of the shootings that we've, you know, consistently seen happen over the last, you know, years. A lot of that is because of the brave students from the high school who have stood up and, you know, at these rallies and said, you know, to the adults, we've got to do something here. We've got to, you know, make a difference. Because in their view, and it's my view as well, there are things that could be done to prevent these kinds of shootings from happening. And of course, that conversation goes back to gun control. And, you know, for Ducey being a conservative Republican, that's not something that typically conservative Republicans are in favor of. But there's an enormous amount of pressure, anti-NRA pressure, that's going around. And I think he has to react to that.
Do either of you think that if the governor convenes such a task force, that all the various stakeholders will be able to come up with some kind of compromise, some kind of agreement that might move the needle on this?
I doubt it, to be honest, given the political sort of winds of Arizona. Maybe in other states it might be different, or maybe at the federal level it might be different. But I think it's difficult here. I mean, we were talking earlier about we can't even ban bump stocks here at the legislature. So asking the legislature to sort of come together with other stakeholders like students, like Democrats, you know, the Giffords groups, for example, to try to do something in a comprehensive fashion, I think is very difficult to ask for.
Jaime, what do you think?
Well, you did a great piece earlier on school resource officers. And just so you know, when I was superintendent, we pushed having school resource officers. And it wasn't so much you having an armed law enforcement officer that can take care of a nut that comes in, but it's more the knowing that there's going to be a presence. And a lot of times when there's a law enforcement presence in schools that is very visible, it deters a lot of bad things from happening in the first place. People forget that when we ran Prop 301, the sales tax that was very popular for schools, part of that money goes for school resource officers. And so what we wanted to do is make sure that schools that don't have access to, you know, like a lot of the wealthier districts, they could use those resources to have somebody there mainly for those purposes. So things like that, I think, are common sense actions that the state could take. And I think convening a group of law enforcement, educators, folks that have a good understanding with good data, hopefully we could come up with something.
And, I mean, the fact that you were superintendent, there's a dramatic difference between having additional school resource officers or training them in a certain way and arming teachers. Is that something that anyone ever brought up to you as a realistic possibility?
You know, that's been talked about for a long, long time. I think it's getting a lot more attention, of course, because of this tragedy. I've always been somewhat skeptical. The reason is because unless you have somebody with a lot of experience, you have somebody that's been either in the military or law enforcement, and then when a situation like this arises, that you don't have gun battles in cafeteria and with people that really don't understand and how to use these weapons. And so I'm not saying that this is an idea that couldn't occur, but I just think that's something that we really, really would have to look at very carefully before implementing it.
Roy, you mentioned gun control briefly, so I wanted to ask you this. Is there, it's almost impossible, it seems, for people to get on the same page with this, but people would argue, do we need fewer guns or do we need more guns to have people sort of save the day? And those are vast differences. What's your basic take on that?
Well, I mean, that is the take. I mean, you asked the question about do we want to arm our teachers. Now, the premise of that, of course, is that by adding more guns to the situation, that's somehow going to reduce the potential violence. We can debate about the efficacy, I think, of having public safety officers in schools. I'd point out that in Parkland, there was a public safety officer there, and he wasn't able to go inside the school and prevent the crime. And so I think it's a lot harder to expect a teacher who has no, you know, training at all to somehow in that brief chaotic moment find a gun in his or her classroom and somehow stop the shooter. I think my take is ultimately that we have to do something about the amount of guns that we have in the society. And in particular, I think what we have to do something about is the amount of assault weapons that we have in the society. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, believe in the Second Amendment, believe in the right to have guns for protection and for hunting. I mean, I grew up hunting. I grew up around guns. I own guns. But I think people like myself look at, you know, AR-15s as something like, why are we allowing people to do that? It's particularly knowing the amount of damage that that kind of gun can do to a crowd of people. And so I think the answer at the end of the day comes back to, can we get rid of those? Can we all agree that we should not have assault weapons allowed for civilians?
Roy, you mentioned that this tragedy seems a little different than the past, that the students are standing up and people are really taking notice. After, for example, Sandy Hook, people said, well, this time will be different. After the Pulse shooting, people said, this time will be different. After the Las Vegas shooting, not that long ago, people said this will be different. What gives you optimism that something might actually happen this time and we won't fall into the same pattern of people talk about a lot of stuff, there's a lot of rhetoric thrown back and forth, and then ultimately, at the end of the day, something bigger comes along, this story kind of fades into the background, and the status quo is maintained?
Well, you're right. I mean, I have some skepticism that we actually will come up with a solution related to this, because as you said, every time we have this shooting, we have the thoughts and prayers type thing, and then at the end of the day, we move on to the next big public policy issue. I think what has occurred here that's slightly different is the students and the amount of attention that the students are getting by fighting back and saying essentially that you guys need to do something, you elected officials need to do something, or we're going to go after you. I think also the sort of anti-NRA rhetoric is much stronger than sometimes it's been before. Because ultimately, a lot of electeds are scared of the NRA, and the NRA is a huge donor. And it's still going to remain a huge donor, but I think there's a lot of people that are saying, you know, we've got to fight back and we've got to kick out these NRA sort of financed politicians. And the timing of this, of course, we're looking at November in a very consequential election overall. And then you add this gun debate to it, and that just adds more fire to the flame.
Hi, mate. This morning, Florida Governor Rick Scott put forward a plan of action, he's calling it. And one of the things that he's including is an age restriction or minimum age requirement to buy some kinds of weapons. I'm wondering if you think that a Republican governor in a state like Florida, if he takes some kind of action and assuming that it goes through, does that give, I don't want to call it political cover, but maybe an impetus to a state like Arizona to try to do something, if not that exact same thing, then maybe something similar?
I think it does. And you have U.S. Senator Flake that came out just a couple of days ago in a bipartisan manner doing a similar thing, saying that you cannot buy these assault-type weapons unless you're 21 years of age. So I think it does. I think there needs to be an honest conversation within Republican leadership ranks that I think Roy has a good point. The NRA, while it's a very important partner, I guess, with a lot of the Republican leadership and Republicans across the country, right now their brand could be detrimental in a lot of races. And you look at the Arizona race and going with a Kyrsten Sinema that's running for the U.S. Senate, if there's a perception that the Republicans are not willing to even deal with any type of issue that deals with gun and school safety, then that'll be at the detriment of the Republican running against her. And so that's something that they need to be aware of.
And Roy, finally, what do you make of what Mark's last question about that? Does that give some sort of political cover here to Governor Ducey, for example, if he decides to act?
Well, I mean, you know, he's got an election himself, right? And he's got to worry about that. Now, I don't expect Governor Ducey to do a 180 on this issue. That's not realistic. But, you know, responding to one of the first questions about a task force, at least showing that we can sit down and talk about reasonable measures to react as opposed to just moving on is probably to his political benefit. But I agree with Jaime. I mean, any Republican that's backed by the NRA, if they indicate that they're essentially going to take the NRA position, which in reaction to this has essentially been, we don't need to do anything, I think that's going to be a problem for them.
That's Roy Herrera. Also here is Jaime Molera. We are in the midst of our Friday Newscap segment here on the show on KJZZ. Still to come, we'll discuss some of the goings-on, probably can't squeeze all of them in, going on in CD8. Stay with us. Good morning. This is the show on 91.5 KJZZ. We're in the midst of our Friday Newscap segment with Mark Brody in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. Also with us, Jaime Molera and Roy Herrera. But now in the race for Congress in the 8th Congressional District, we turn to KJZZ's Brett Jaspers. Debbie Lesko is getting scrutiny for her campaign finance moves, and we'll talk about the politics behind that. But first, here to explain the campaign finance story is Brett. Brett, good morning.
Good morning.
So what did Debbie Lesko do?
Lesko was in the state Senate, right, until she resigned to run for Congress. And she had all this money in her state Senate reelection fund. And so earlier this week, it came out that she took $50,000 of that and gave it to a super PAC that's supporting her new congressional race. Super PACs aren't supposed to coordinate activities with the federal candidates they support.
So very important question here, then, is what she did illegal?
Her lawyers insist that it's perfectly legal because they didn't coordinate any activities as to how the money was spent, and Lesko didn't participate in establishing the super PAC. I tried to talk to federal and state regulators, but they didn't want to weigh in on this. So I called a couple of folks in the watchdog world. One of them was Paul Ryan with Common Cause in D.C.
And what did Paul Ryan tell you?
He said that there's an important bit of context here. It's long been established that a candidate can't take state campaign funds and use it in his or her federal election. That's to prevent donors from, you know, giving to the state campaign and then to the federal campaign and going over the allowed donation limits. But this particular transfer was to a federal super PAC, not a campaign committee. And here's why Ryan's concerned about that.
This is clearly an end run around the candidate contribution limits and the prohibition on transferring money directly from a state candidate account to a federal candidate account. And it's an end run that undermines the integrity of the $2,700 contribution limit.
And Brett, $2,700 is the maximum an individual can give to a candidate running for federal office.
Right. But the FEC hasn't explicitly said that this end run, as he calls it, is illegal. And that's where one gray area is. Lesko's lawyers are also making the argument that the state campaign donations that add up to the $50,000 were all individually under federal donation limits. Ryan says it depends on how you look at it. And the FEC hasn't given explicit guidance on that either.
And what about this key issue of coordination? You're saying that Lesko's lawyers say there wasn't any, and that's what matters.
Right. They said, quote, the state committee and the federal committee never discussed how the funds would be used or how the transfer would be reported, unquote. But Paul Ryan at Common Cause said the fact that almost all of the super PAC's money, you know, came from the state Senate campaign calls into question the super PAC's status as a super PAC or an independent expenditure group.
This group is not really an independent group if Lesko or any agent of Lesko established, financed, maintained, or controlled, and if almost the entirety of their money is from Lesko, then Lesko has arguably financed this group, and it's not a legitimate independent super PAC. It's an extension of Lesko's own federal candidate campaign.
Another good government lawyer told me the same thing. And if it is deemed an extension of her campaign, then it's subject to the same donation limits.
And you talked to Debbie Lesko on the campaign trail. What did she say?
Yeah, well, this was before the Yellow Sheet report broke the story. I just asked how super PACs affect a primary campaign. She said she didn't know the super PAC supporting her, but that she was grateful for their support.
So my signs are the ones with the face on them. And the other ones that just say my name were paid for by, I believe it was conservative leadership of Arizona. And they and Defend U.S. PAC have also mailed out some mailers on my behalf. So I'm very thankful for them. I don't know who they are, but I'm very thankful.
It seems unlikely that she doesn't know who conservative leadership for Arizona is, given that her state Senate campaign gave it $50,000. But again, the Lesko campaign vehemently denies any charge of illegality.
From KJZZ's West Valley Bureau, Brett Jaspers. Brett, thanks.
You're welcome.
This is the Friday Newscap on KJZZ. Roy Herrera, Jaime Molera here. Let's talk about this idea. And the issue of coordination seems to be a really key one here. Jaime, does it... I don't want to ask you to get into the legal stuff here, sure. But can a campaign give another organization money and not have it coordinate in some way?
Well, and I'm not an attorney, but I'll always give my legal opinion on anything. whether it's illegal or not, one of the things that I would say, it just doesn't look good. It just doesn't pass that political smell test. And so why they would do that in the first place, it's not... I'm a little bit dumbfounded as to why they would do that.
Well, I am a campaign finance attorney. It's actually my specialty. But in the interest of full disclosure, I'm representing Dr. Harold Tupernini, who's a Democratic candidate in CD8. So I'm going to sort of not give my legal opinion as to the legality of that, given that that might be something that's a subject of the general election campaign.
Sure.
But what I'll say is I agree with Jaime. It's to me, didn't make a ton of sense given the amount of money. I mean, we're talking about $50,000 and the amount of attention that this has received now because, as Jaime says, it doesn't pass the smell test. It's a bit shady, if you will. Now, campaign finance law is inherently complicated. The Federal Election Commission, which we referred to earlier, is basically been non-functioning for a long time. And so because of the amount of money that goes through campaigns and the creative attorneys like myself and others, things happen sometimes that maybe make sense from a legal perspective, but maybe not from a political perspective.
Because of the compressed time period, this is interesting as well, because the special election has been so strange that a lot of voters probably had already voted by the time this even came about. So, I mean, politically, this doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Well, I've heard about 75% of the voters in that area have already did their mail-in ballots. But the one thing that Debbie Lesko has going for her is that there's another candidate that's having another little bit of an issue.
I think we'll probably get into that.
Yeah. But that's what it comes down to. Who's going to be able to weather this bad media storm? And to me, the storm that she's going through is a lot less intense than the storm that her opponent, Steve Montenegro, is going through.
Let me throw in one more campaign finance question. And Roy, let me direct it at you. One of the things that no one really cares about, my opinion, but that has driven me nuts for years, it happened with our former attorney general when he got into some trouble as well, that when the campaign finance investigation is done, it is typically after a person has left office or 3 years after the election occurred. So what kind of improvements could we have in that area?
Well certainly quickening the pace of investigations for complaints, I think, would be good for just the way our elections work, right? But as you mentioned, I mean, campaigns go into the campaign knowing that if I file a complaint against you, even if it's sort of on the edge of being, proper or improper, that ultimately that's not going to be adjudicated until we're well past this election. And so you almost use it as a tool, unfortunately, to get a media story out of it and say, hey, my opponent is doing the XYZ thing wrong and bending the rules or breaking the rules.
Jaime, you opened the door, so I guess we have to walk through it now, talking about Steve Montenegro's text message habits. I don't even really know what to ask about this other than, like, what do you make of all of this that's going on with he and this junior staffer in the state Senate?
Well, I guess I'll just stick to the politics of it. And the politics of it is that when you have somebody who's an evangelical minister that purports to be incredibly tight with that community and then all of a sudden engage in activity that is immoral for a married man to engage in that. So that's going to hurt him. And that's going to hurt him in a district that has a large population of that like mindset. And one of the things that I think is going to hurt him the most is that you have two individuals that have come out that I think have a lot of weight. And one is Kathy Herrod, the head of the Center for Arizona Policy, very strong conservative organization, and a lot of times will decide in those kinds of districts because of their support. She said he needs to drop out of the race. And then Jan Brewer. Jan Brewer is still very popular amongst Republicans.
Lives in that district.
Lives in that district and extremely popular in that area. Also called on him to resign. So those are the two things. Now, if he had enough early ballots before this tsunami hit him, then he might have win, which then talks about whether or not he could survive the storm if he were to move on to the general election.
Do the details of this case matter to voters? I mean, do they care that he says, I didn't have an inappropriate relationship to, or do people just say he got topless photos of a woman who is not his wife?
Well, it wouldn't matter. Well, I guess it would have less of an impact, especially on the perception of folks, if there was no fire behind this smoke. But what will kill him at the end of the day is that he says, oh, I didn't do anything. Oh, I didn't even get these texts. Well, yes, you did, because we can prove he got this text. And then now he's admitting to getting the text. He's admitting to getting these pictures. Now he's saying, wow, but I didn't do anything with them. So the question is, if there's that next group of texts that were out there, that could be very damaging to him.
Corey, there's a question about voting behavior, which we could do for a million years and not actually figure out why voters vote the way they do. But Trent Franks ultimately left a very safe seat because of things that had stirred up around him. Now, those of us in the journalism community and people in the political community had heard things about Trent Franks for years. And I don't know if there wasn't enough momentum to do those things or not, but voters kept voting him in. So to veer off that question a bit, Montenegro is proving by this that he does not live up to the morals that he talks about. But to be very cynical, politicians often don't. So is this really enough for him to drop out because what he did was a question of character, but not a question of true illegality?
Well, part of what's happening here, too, is a much larger national conversation about sexual harassment and inappropriate relationships at work and with, you know, with people that, particularly politicians, with people that they work with. So, you know, I think that the fact that we've been having this conversation for months, the timing for Mr. Montenegro is not very good, because I think we're all sort of naturally inclined to say, hey, we've got to do something about this and these kinds of things shouldn't happen. You add to the fact the hypocrisy of his sort of public image of being a preacher and sort of a holier-than-thou conservative, it's really damaging. And, you know, to Jaime's point, I mean, the story has kind of changed from his, you know, from his end over the last week or so. And I think that's only made it worse. I mean, had he sort of come out and explained honestly sort of the extent of what occurred, maybe it would have been different. But ultimately, there's a lot of forces here that I think are just going against him.
And one other thing, Jaime, that I thought was interesting in all the texts, which we haven't talked about because it doesn't have the kind of salaciousness, was the comments that he was making about Michelle Reagan when he was considering running for Secretary of State against her had very negative things to say about her as well. And does this – ultimately, does this make him persona non grata in the Republican Party if he loses this race?
Well, and I'll tell you what, if he wins this race, this primary, there's going to be a lot of consternation amongst Republicans, because all of a sudden you get people like Roy Heredia gets very happy – because you're supporting the candidate that then could be, all of a sudden, it's almost the Alabama Roy Moore effect. The Democrats that really should have absolutely no chance of winning this race, absolutely no chance, then they have a chance, right? Because then you have people like a Jan Brewer and a Kathy Hare that I mentioned earlier that have already said he should step out because of moral lapses. How do you then stand and say, well, you know what? Yeah, he has moral lapses, but we're going to stand behind them. That becomes very difficult, and I think the Republicans right now are really hoping against hope that somebody else, probably Debbie Lesko, can pull this off.
Do either of you think that either of these issues, the Debbie Lesko campaign finance or the Steve Montenegro tax, does that in any way affect who might decide to get into the primary for the regular midterm election, the primary which will be coming up in August?
If this story, let's say Senator Lesko were to win, comes Congressman Lesko. If there is validity in the illegality of this and it becomes more of a snowball effect, then possibly she could have some trouble.
I mean, I think with Deb Lesko, campaign finance violation, while it's interesting, is not as sort of damaging or as sexy, let's say, as some of the allegations that are coming out against Montenegro. So certainly, if somehow Montenegro is able to pull out this primary, mostly because a lot of the votes have already come in before this came out, then I think, yeah, you'd see some Republicans that say, wow, he's pretty weak, so why don't we go and try to primary him?
Jaime, finally, very last question, just a few seconds left. Which would be worse for the GOP, Joe Arpaio winning the Senate primary or Montenegro winning this congressional primary?
Boy, that's a Hobson's choice.
Jaime, can I just say
I would say Joe Arpaio, because being in the U.S. Senate is a little bit higher level, and we might be able to live with one congressional loss.
Well, all I was going to say is I'm rooting for Joe Arpaio. That's all I'll say.
Attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera and Jaime Molera of Molera Alvarez, Arizona's former superintendent of public instruction. Guys, thanks for joining us on the NewsCap.
Thank you very much.
And the show continues. You've been listening to the Friday NewsCap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.